Hi, this is Vashi Nedimansky. I'm co-founder of Vashi Visuals and a film editor living in Los Angeles and working here for the last 20 years. Today I wanted to share a conversation I had with a good friend of mine and fellow hockey player by the name of Peter Markle. He's a director in Hollywood for almost 30 years. He's done several movies I'm sure you've heard of, including one of my favorites as a hockey player, Youngblood, with Patrick Swayze and Rob Lowe. He did the film Flight 93. He's done Hot Dog the Movie, another classic from the 80s. He's done Bat 21 with Gene Hackman. He's worked on several episodes of ER and The X-Files as the director. And today we're going to discuss his new film called Odds Are. It's a micro-budget film that was shot in his house in Santa Monica, on the pier and all over, with no permits, no rules, a small crew. And I wanted to talk to him about his filmmaking process and how he put this all together and why he did it. So it's about 45 minutes long, so sit back and enjoy my conversation with director Peter Markle. You have a new film coming out August 7th called Odds Are.
Right.
I'd love to hear about, first, where did the idea come from? How do you approach this? And why did you want to do Odds Are? And then I want to go over the production itself. And I want to go over at the end of the marketing and the approach of how do you put this in front of eyeballs? How do you get people interested in this? I know each of those are separate challenges, and I'd love to have just a conversation about that. Why did you choose Odds Are, and how, what was the start of this whole concept for this film?
Well, I had a friend that the very first film I did was a film called The Personals, and we did it in a vacuum in Minneapolis. And the reason we got it made is because we didn't know anything about the business. We knew how to make films. And my editor, Steve Rifkin, he came out here and he ended up being all the Pirates movies.
One of the biggest
Avatars.
And yes.
So, but at any rate, he and I had some skills. We knew filmmaking. I'd shot probably 800,000 feet of footage before we made that. That's all with 60 millimeter on a NPR. Mm-hmm. And so we made this film, The Personals. It was ran a comedy and it got great reviews. Roger Corman picked it up and put it through his classics division. So the reason I really think that was successful is because we didn't know how hard the business was. So when we came out, somebody picked it up and I got an agent. So that's how I got in town. But I never would have been able to go to LA and start being a filmmaker there. I just would have found it. You needed a calling card. I wanted to skip this down. I didn't want to go to film school because, as you know, I did not go to film school because so 26, I was actually in graduate school at the University of Minnesota. I'd gone to Yale, then I'd played 4 years of hockey with the U.S. team and four minor league teams, actually. So something like you.
Yeah.
So I basically was in the New York Islands training camp at 26, so I was kind of an old rookie.
So was I. I was 26 when I went
to New York Islanders. But this was the year they had Dennis Potvin's first year.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so I played with him, saw him play. But basically, I was in kind of the rookie camp.
Yep.
And then I went in to see Moose Lalo at the end, mm-hmm. and he was coaching Muskegon. And he said, okay, I want you to come play for Muskegon. I said, I don't think so, Moose. He said, well, what do you mean? I said, you're not going to play hockey? And he couldn't conceive of anybody giving up hockey. He said, well, what are you going to do? I said, I'm going to direct. So literally, I had some money from a student loan that I had not paid off, you know, but it was $600, so I bought a Bolex, and I started making films.
And you didn't have any film school experience, and you just...
No.
Why the appeal of directing or filmmaking at that point?
Because I'd always loved movies. It was I remember seeing Shane. I would go to movies with my dad at least once a week. I just loved films. And I also at college, I had some really good art history teachers, and I minored in art history, and I was good at it. So all my friends were going to Harvard Business School or Harvard Law School or Yale, whatever.
And you took a left turn.
Yeah, I think out of the 1,000 kids in our class, 400 must have gone to law school.
Yeah.
And some became great novelists or whatever, you know, and a lot of doctors and so forth.
Were there any other filmmakers in that group?
Well, Oliver Stone was was in our freshman class, but he didn't last, you know, he took off and went to Vietnam, which was probably great for his film career, obviously, because he had some pretty good basis for like, okay, here's a film that I know something about.
Right. So that knowledge of going in without knowing certain components was beneficial for your first film.
Yeah, I think so. But I'd done a lot of documentaries and a couple of high-end industrial films.
And you had a good group, a core group that were working.
The people that knew what they were doing. And Steve was just starting out, you know. And I mean, just as a kind of an anecdote, because a lot of people are trying to figure out how to get into the business. I mean, you do a feature film and it's, you know, it's good enough to get, you know, platform, whether it's digitally or whether it's theatrically, you know, it'll get you going. My partner, Pat Wells, who was the producer with me, he said, look, I've got a friend who's in LA and he had just made a film. It didn't do very well, but he's the guy that knows everything, right? So it was Bill Melamed, great guy. He's passed away since. So Pat said that we're doing this film. He said, what are you doing a film for? You guys don't know what you're doing. You're in Minneapolis. You're idiots. And then Bill said, you know what, Pat? I'm going to come and pull the plug on your own movie. So Bill comes to Minneapolis, and Steve and I said, well, let's put something together for him. So Rifkin and I cut this 10-minute short, little, you know, and we only had about 30 minutes of film at that point. We just kind of condensed it. So Bill looks at it, gave us $100,000. We made an executive producer, and we finished the film. And we bought a bunch of music with it.
Sure.
Neil Young rights, and that's how I got in. So at any rate, that was the personals. So I'm doing the same film over again, you know, decades later.
Right.
So because I was doing a lot of episodics, I had a couple surgeries, so that slowed me down for a little bit. So I hadn't done an episodic. I hadn't worked in like a year, but I was writing. Mm-hmm. And my daughter used to play this game called Odds Are, which is basically a game of chance where you challenge somebody to do it. It's a little like Truth or Dare, but it's a little different dynamic to it. Yeah. And so they would like go knock on a door. They'd say, you know, you've got to go over there and take a selfie with five guys, mm-hmm. you know, five different guys, selfies with five different guys, whatever. And you base it on odds. So it's like rolling the dice.
Yeah.
Then she was at a camp in Michigan, Interlaken, very good
Absolutely.
Arts camp. Yeah.
Yep.
And she said, no, I just got back from Eastern Europe and I played that game. And somebody that I played with had a horrible experience. And there was a fake hanging. There were a few other things that happened. So I said, well, that's enough for us to make a film on.
So this is in collaboration with your daughter.
Yeah, with my daughter, yeah. Okay, wow. So we kind of banged out kind of a story. Mm-hmm. But I wrote the script. You know, that in the meantime, she went off to college. So it's based on actual events. And we transposed it to Santa Monica. Mm-hmm.
What were your couple main reasons for wanting to make this film?
Well, for all of the above, wanted to do a film where I had total control, but it's still a partnership and you're still working with other people. You know, also it was something that I could design where I could keep the budget at a certain level mm-hmm. and not exceed it. And we basically came in the right number. Mm-hmm. Although there's some things afterwards that you want to maybe spend a little more money on media, that type of thing. I had a very good friend of mine that said, you should, you know, you've learned all this, you've done 80 projects in the system. Mm-hmm. And that actually wouldn't have included the first film, The Personals, because that wasn't the system.
Right.
So go do your own film, you know, where you're not, you know, you don't have a whole chain of command, you know, that you're dealing with. And you'll get your own edit.
Yeah.
So that's was the main reason. I thought it would be, I had the advantage of being in Santa Monica, so we took advantage of the beaches and the pier and the neighborhoods. We shot a ton of stuff north of Montana. Nobody shoots north of Montana. I've never seen a feature film shoot north of Montana. And we shot 14.
And what was the main location?
Well, we shot in the house for 14 days and nights.
And that's your house?
Yeah, splits. That was 14 days.
Okay.
And the total, I think we shot a total 25 days, including two pickup days. Yeah. Both were here, and I think one we did at the beach. But it was really, it was something I could keep kind of contained, even though, and then we budgeted a certain amount for stunts, and we brought in real stunt people that I worked before with on bigger, huge budgets, you know. So you basically plan, okay, we can have this many stunts in the film. So it was not going to be a slam bam film with a huge action.
But just, you know, big moments, special moments.
Yeah, there are moments, you know, but you try to keep the tension. So a little more Hitchcockian than, you know, the typical action film today, the Mission Impossible, you know, where it's one, you know,
set piece after another.
After 3 minutes
so
or something.
So you're going psychological.
Yes, you have to, because, and it's also the type of film I want to watch. I'd rather watch Hitchcock than a lot of the big action films today. So, you know, that's basically it. And I needed to cast it out and crew it out. And I found a casting director who did a great job finding people. And we brought in non-union actors. We brought in some really strong actors, but when you go in and you're going to do an episodic, mm-hmm. you bring an actress in for, let's say they've got three lines, or not three lines, let's say three or four pages. Mm-hmm. You bring in real actors to handle that. if they bring in 20 actors, everyone is fantastic. I mean, the minimum requirements, like Yale School of Drama.
Yeah.
You know, that's right. Okay, so that's fine.
Yeah.
And everybody is fantastic. So in this situation, especially non-union, if somebody's going to be in L.A. and trying to learn how to act, and they're non-union, and they haven't been in SAG yet, mm-hmm. they're going to be worse than somebody picking than you're going to pick off the street in Minneapolis.
Yeah.
You know, so it was extremely hard, and I thought that the cast director did a wonderful job because he found me enough people to fill the roles, and right. we had very few roles to fill.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that worked out okay.
Right.
And then everybody was paying, you know, low budget or new media or whatever.
Sure, there's rules for that no matter what.
Yeah.
And you're the hats you wore on this production. You were the writer, the director, the producer. What other?
Well, yeah, Jared. When Jared came on, he was so unbelievable that I gave him producer credit, shared producer credit with me because he did so much and he slept so little and he just understood it because he's in the business, he's made films, and he's done a lot of production work. So he was the production designer.
Yeah. And Jared's last name is?
Jared Hines. Okay. Yeah, he's from Minnesota.
Okay.
And then from Mark Irwin, a DP that I really respect, that I asked to do it. And he would have done it for, you know, it's a really huge cut on salary. But I think it would have driven him crazy. So in retrospect, it was better using the person he suggested, who was mentoring in Andy Fronczak, who was 21 years old, mm-hmm. who was absolutely fantastic. So I got this kid. It's still in school. He was actually late one day because he had a class. But he came and lit a scene in the house, you know, and I was like kind of the subject and just moving from A to B. And it looked great. So I went with him, you know, and it's give him a break. And, you know, we really do his stuff.
Do you push harder if they are less experienced so you can pass it on to them? Or because if you're patient, they may not know the tempo that this has to go at. Right.
Well, he had shot a lot.
Okay.
He'd shot a lot before, a lot of B camera, a lot of A camera. So he was actually experienced for that age. And I think LMU has a decent film school.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
They do.
But obviously he doesn't know what Mark knows or Donnie Burgess does or Fade and Papa Michael, who I've worked with, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's a little different. All the DPs have different MOs, you know. But I love DPs. Mm-hmm. So I always get along with them. And Andy had, you know, really strong opinions for his age, and there was a bit of tweaking in between setups, you know, that normally you don't have when you're dealing with, you know, experienced DP.
Right.
But he was tough. He was strong. You know, he was there. We handheld almost the entire film, and a lot of it doesn't look handheld.
Okay.
And then we did have a tripod for the long lens, where we had a bunch of long lens Canon zooms. The rest of the film was all shot in Zeiss primes.
Right.
And he shot everything in the house at 1.8, everything. 1.4 to 1.8.
Oh, wow.
You know, which was hard on the focus puller. But fortunately, we had focus puller that was with us 90% of the time. It was really good.
What camera did you shoot on for this?
We shot with a Canon 300 Mark II.
Yep.
And
single camera?
Single camera. We had I had an NEX 7.
Yep.
That with a 3/4 and or 4/3, I guess they call it, right?
Micro 4/3.
Yeah. And when we were out of the beach and guys were going to go do this whole swimming thing and drowning thing, I shot with that. Drove Andy nuts that I was using. And I was using a monopod.
Yep.
And it's funky focus and all that.
Did you cut some of that?
Oh
stuff
yeah, in? It looked fine.
Yeah.
It totally looked fine because it's 1080 and it's like, is there a little bit of difference? Yeah, but it's looked good.
And you can grade, usually you can grade the difference out of it or add grain.
Surprising how good it is. And we shot with the iPhone too, but it was with the iPhone because they were taking video selfies.
Sure.
The iPhone looks like video more so, and you can't pan it.
Right.
But it's for the film, you want it to look
for
like
story
that.
Moments, for, things
for
that
story
you mean,
moments, like, and the whole thing behind the scenes, that we did steal this location, that was all shot with. I went out and shot in an hour and a half. I got all those shots
it's
at the
amazing,
pier.
Amazing, right? No one knows, no one cares if you're holding an iPhone and walking.
No,
around.
An iPhone. And then we had, you know, we would if we went into the arcade in the on the pier, we used the 5D and stripped it down. But we got kicked out of there 3 times, and we just kept coming back or went to another part of the arcade. With the actors.
Fearless. So so there's no security, there's no barricades, it's just you running around the pier to get those shots, obviously.
Yeah, we were kicked off the pier dozens of times, and then we just kept coming back. And I was the old film professor, and Andy was a film student, you know. So
that was the game you were playing?
Oh, that was a game.
Okay.
And
did you get in any real trouble from that, or just
No, it was just people kind of put up with us, and people said there was a couple people worked around there, And they thought that, you know, do you guys have a permit? I said, yeah, we have a permit.
Yeah.
Can we see it? Well, we'll go find it. It's in the parking lot.
Yeah, so, the producer over there.
Yeah, so, but what was interesting, when we were on the beach, we were shooting, and the actress wanted to have a lifeguard. Mm-hmm. So the guy shows up, and he's dressed just like the lifeguard in Santa Monica.
Yeah.
Really bad idea. So another lifeguard with binoculars about 300 yards away sees this happen. Mm. And the reason he comes and he shuts us down and throws us off the beach. We're just ready to finish the last few shots, basically all the water shots.
Yeah. And this is because you can't have something that looks like a lifeguard that's not actually a lifeguard.
No, because they get paid like $3,000 for that's how they make money.
Gotcha.
So that's one of the ways they make money. So it's like they threw us off. So we went back a week later and we went further north.
Okay.
And we had used no. We took all the sound off the camera.
Okay.
And then we just looped it.
Yeah.
So
there are no booms, no mics.
Yeah. It was just the 5D.
A lot more invisible.
Yeah, a lot more invisible. And again, sound smart post with Joe Melody's company.
Yeah.
Had a fantastic ADR, and they had no problem. We ADR'd 50% of the movie.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah.
Is that because you just couldn't capture it at the time, or just easier to get the image and then add the dialogue in later?
Yeah, there were problems when we were shooting in the car, you know, and some of that might have been my fault, or we're running out of batteries, or the miking was weird, and you're at the pier and it's noisy, you know, so you get a guide track, and it sounded fine, you know, we didn't spend that much time in ADR. We had really good, I mean, total pros in there over at sound Smart Post. So that was a decision that I'm really glad I made, because there are all sorts of like mom and pop mixing situations, you know. Mm-hmm. But I think I would end up spending more and not gotten nearly as much.
Over your past, how important is sound and audio to you as a director to watch a final product?
Well, it's amazingly important. You know, that's why I hired Nick Pike to do the music, who was really experienced and has won an Emmy. And I'd done a project with him in Nova Scotia that was called Virginia's Run. It was a kid's film, but it was a beautiful orchestral score. Mm-hmm. We actually scored it with the Prague Film Orchestra, but it's really the Philharmonic.
Yeah, yeah.
And we did that
online.
In a house in Venice.
Yeah,
yeah. So when they took a break, we took a break. We were taking a break in the kitchen, and we were saying, "Hey, where are you guys?" Yeah. So the Czech conductors can speak English, and that was part of the deal in Czech, obviously.
Yeah.
So he said, like, "Come on," and all the orchestras are waiting for us. You know, it's like 30-40 piece orchestra.
So you get a beautiful, original, natural, real performance. Nothing synthesized.
Yeah, no, that was from the Virginia's Run.
Right.
Yeah. And so I used Nick Pike to do this one. And this one we did the whole thing in his house, his studio.
Yeah.
Normally with Nick, we'll bring in an iwi guy, you know, electronic wind instrument guy, or we'll bring in a guitarist. But he can do the piano, and he's got instruments there that sound like guitars and things. So he did a fantastic score for us.
Well, just like the technology of the cameras and everything else is improving, like the sonic sounds and the actual representation of acoustic instruments and real instruments are now like indistinguishable to me, at least.
Well, and I did a film with Ramin Djawadi. I did one of the first, I think it was a good break for him, and I'll tell you that. And it was a thing about, it was about Jessica Lynch, that was a catastrophe that happened in An Nasiriyah, where 11 Americans were killed in this convoy thing. And so Jessica Lynch was one of the people that was rescued subsequently. It became kind of a PR thing, but at any rate, it was a real event and was a horrible situation. And so I went down, I hired Ramin to do the score, and it's a sensational score. And everything was done in his room. We didn't bring anybody in, but Hans Zimmer has fantastic sampled strings because we had a lot of strings in it.
Yeah.
So I learned a lot there. Yeah. And then Ramin, of course, did Game of Thrones and a lot of films since then.
So did you get Hans's strings?
Yeah. It's one of the reasons we went there.
Usually they stay on an independent film. To be in one location is great. You're here in this house for 15 days.
14 days.
What was your experience? Some of the positives and negatives. I mean, not having a company move has got to be nice. Everyone can show up here. Yeah. You're trying to keep the crew small. But what were some of the other things you discovered about shooting in one location?
Well, if
and it's your house.
Yeah, if you're shooting north of Montana, you can't park all the cars in the same street. So everybody had to park in different areas, and some people would have to walk two blocks, which is no big deal. So that was a whole deal.
Because of the neighbors?
Yeah, because there's a ton of people here that are filmmakers, and filmmakers don't want filmmakers shooting in their neighborhood. Yeah, is it Inyurati? How do you pronounce his name?
Inyurati.
Inyurati. He lives around here a couple blocks away. Mammoth lives down the street. Yeah. I mean, there's a ton of people live in this neighborhood. So
they don't want to see trucks or cars.
No, there's no truck. We had no trucks. We never had a truck. We had an electrician for 14 days when we were shooting the house.
Okay.
And he was fantastic. And he had a van. And everything came out of the van. It was like a Rubik's Cube trying to get it back in. And that was the noisiest part, trying to keep them as quiet as possible because the neighbors are, you know, there's like 11-foot easement in between houses here. Every piece of this house we used. Yeah. We were on the roof for a dive off the roof. We used the pool, obviously. There's like little pathways around the guest house. I've got a basement with a skate sharpener down there. I've got a crawl space. Mm-hmm. We've got an attic, the various bedrooms. You know, we had whatever the footprint was here. You design the script around that. Mm-hmm. And then after the film was done, I went around and pretended I was the actors for all the Foley. I basically did all the Foley in the house. Smart Post would enhance it, or they would bring some of their own sampled stuff.
So you're just capturing Foley running around the house with like a handheld recorder?
Yeah.
And just, okay.
Yeah, and the dog, I would take to dog parks, and as soon as we got within 300 yards of the dog park, he'd start whining, going crazy. And that's basically his ADR for the film.
Right.
Yeah, you know, so we used a lot. And when we started the film, he was 50 pounds. Now he's 100 pounds. So we did a reshoot of him at 80 pounds, but nobody, you can't really tell.
Actors, I tell you, once they get a little taste.
Yeah, he's sleeping right now, right there.
He's got to sleep it off.
Yeah.
And the shoot went rather, did it go smoothly?
Were there any major hiccups? We never went over 12 hours, basically 10 hours. And we did splits in the house. The big problem was we started shooting all night here. Like we would be out at 4:30, 5 o'clock. And one of the neighbors went absolutely bananas. And she had a right to, you know, because I had told her, well, we're going to have 3 or 4 people. And I'd already cleared it with her. But then I had 14 and somebody was shining a big HDMI right into her window. Oh. You know, so I made a deal with her that we would be inside of the house at 9:30. But we would still have to hold our breath because we'd be lighting through the window so that there would be people outside still making noise.
Yeah, yeah.
And the crew would wander out and start making noise because once you get into that night shooting, that's your day. So, you know, you have lunch at 12 o'clock or something. So, you know,
to function like a human being.
Yeah. So I would spend half my time telling people to, you know, 3, 2, 1, quiet.
Yeah.
You know, crisscross applesauce. You know, it's like, oh my God. That was one of the hardest things. We would do splits, so we would shoot a lot of the day stuff. Then we'd go into nights, and we'd pre-light as much as we could, even before it got dark.
Sure.
And then we freewheeled around the neighborhood for all of our car driving stuff. We never asked for any permission to do that. But, you know, again, it was we did some lighting in the car, and then we had a hood mount, and then we had behind the
French. You just drive around the neighborhood.
Drove around the neighborhood forever. Yeah, we did that during the day and at night.
Okay. Any cops or neighbors at any point? I'm sure you got some looks.
We passed a couple cops. They really didn't care. We were okay. There's a lot of ADT, security personnel. Yeah. But, I had a young crew. It makes a total difference. I mean, you look pretty harmless, and it looked, everything was mounted professionally.
Okay.
We shot up in the desert, obviously, and then we shot, the pier, and we were, Santa Monica. We shot, the hairiest thing was we had an extensive scene below the pier where all the, pylons
are.
Yeah, and that was a long scene with the two girls. It's kind of a resolution of the film. And that was 4 pages. So we got kicked out of there and the guy left and we kept shooting. We got kicked out again, the guy left, we reset up and finished it. And we could not put any lights up, no bounce, but the light was perfect coming off the water. It was soft. The lighting was fantastic.
Shimmery, yeah.
Consistent, never changed during the day.
Right.
Incredibly noisy, obviously, and that whole thing had to be ADR'd. So we got, decent audio for his audio track.
But you got your visuals there, and so this guy would leave and come back, and you're like, yeah, we'll just pack up, and you would keep shooting. How were the actors? How did the actors respond?
It was fine. It was harder on me than the actors. The actors were pretty good. They really didn't. Shooting around the piers, if you have to pick one spot in the United States, it's going to be hard to shoot. It's going to be the Santa Monica Pier.
It's so like visible. It's so like iconic. Though.
When they also, when you get a permit, there's 3 permits you have to get.
Okay.
It's like the city, whoever is in control of the pier, and each concession.
Yeah.
So there's three owners, basically.
Right.
So it's incredibly complex and expensive.
And you had none of these?
No, none of them.
And the ramifications, had a cop come over, what could have they done?
They just shut you down. What are they going to do? They're not going to throw us in jail. Just,
right.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm the old film instructor, and this is my students, and we're just making a short.
Yeah.
And I didn't have any actors that were noticeable, obviously.
Okay.
But it's really, it was hard. I mean, it was hard on me. And also for the parking lot was great because we stage out of the parking lot, out of the back of our vans.
$10 a car, put them together.
$10, yeah. And I had to go in and out like four or five times. Finally, the guy said, and he didn't know we were shooting.
Yeah.
He said, go on. You paid enough today. I already paid $50. Because we'd go up on the bluff on Palisades, and we had shots near the end of the movie, the guy riding his bicycle, so we got a big wide shot.
Sure.
You know, I would never do it again. Let's put it that way. I'd rather get the permits.
So you started that way, then you were in the studio, you're in the system. I'm sure a lot more amenities the whole time. Did you have any amenities for your small crew?
We had fantastic cook came in, a girl named Groupsy, Asian, and she made fantastic Asian food. The only food that she would make, like five different types of food. Mm-hmm. There'd be Italian, Mexican, Thai, Chinese, and American. Mm-hmm. Nobody liked the American food. The American food sucked. Everything else was fantastic.
Yeah.
And then she would all the leftovers, she'd put in these big containers, and they'd go into my refrigerator. Groupsy was fantastic. So we fed the crew great.
Okay.
And we did have kind of a craft services going. There was always food around.
Yeah, yeah.
Which you have to do. You have to do that no matter what your budget is.
And it can't
be
just pizzas all day either.
No.
Everyone will shut down.
I don't think we did pizzas more than three times in the whole movie, really.
Yeah.
And when we were up in Mojave, we had group meals together.
Yeah.
And then here's another thing that's interesting. When we went to Mojave, Jared went up there and made a deal on the Motel 6.
Yeah.
And he ended up getting it for $24 a night per room.
Per room.
And he said, so we're going to double, everybody's going to double up. No, give everybody a room because I'm going to have a room by myself. Give everybody a room.
Yeah.
The kids on the crew could not believe it. It's the first time they ever had a room by themselves. I mean, normally they put five people in one room.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, for an indie film.
And everyone's charging stuff and backing up footage all night.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
So they're like rock stars in the desert.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't the greatest. But the film, the hotel's fine. You have a good TV. It's actually a good little business hotel.
So you get all that stuff done. How did you approach your post-production? Because, again, with cameras and time and editors and all these components, like how much time did you allot for post-production? Or is that a benefit of having an independent film where you're like, it'll take longer because no one's waiting for it?
Well, we did take quite a while on post, but the biggest problem in post was, downloading it properly because every night I had a different like third AC.
Yeah.
And that was horrifying to me. And some were really good and some were a little sloppy.
Yeah.
And we actually lost almost a day total, I would say. We had to reshoot because we couldn't find the footage or it wasn't transcribed, wasn't downloaded.
Yeah.
So what I would do is after we were done shooting, like at 4 o'clock, I'd hang around and wait for the person to get done with it.
Yeah.
Then I would take the original tapes.
Yes.
Up to my bedroom.
And you can review it there.
Just so it was there. In the morning, I would try to have Andy check it.
Yeah.
But it was really hard from doing. Sometimes Andy did it, the DP, but I had to get him off.
You're prepping for the next day as well.
Yeah, yeah. And he needed sleep. It wasn't a question of getting him off the clock. He had to sleep, so because we're going to have somebody else come in and to be the third AC, I guess you would call it, right?
Yeah. Or and, DIT, now it's, everyone has, but that's like the...
Well, we didn't have a DIT, so we didn't have somebody who was overall taking, so the footage was scattered all over the place, but I had two very good editors, Charlie Rifkin, who was Steve's nephew, who Steve suggested.
Yeah.
So Charlie, I hired for like 10 weeks. After that, he had to take another job, but he really got the film underway.
Yep.
And then I hired a friend of mine, Dennis Pasaggio, who was also executive producer on the film and did the sound. And it was fantastic. I mean, he's still been working with me on it, on Blu-rays and everything else.
Yep.
He told me, here's an editor you've got to use. And the editor was much older than the editor I've used and never done a feature. And I loved him. I thought he was fantastic. I mean, he was as good as editors I've worked with, really. I mean, not as quick, but he had a wonderful sensibility. He was totally...
I was going to say, what do you look for in an editor? Because it is such a huge relationship between the director and the editor. You're going to spend so much time together. Like, I'm very careful with who I work with as directors because you're locked in. And if it's someone that you don't aren't that compatible with. If it's just a paycheck, great, but there's got to be more to it than that.
Yeah, it's really hard. I mean, it's a you want an editor that's going to work the footage longer than you're going to work. And that's the one thing about Steve Rifkin,
yeah,
who was unbelievable. You know, I said, Steve, I think we've got it. He said, let me take another shot at it. Let me just go through the footage one more time. And I think that's why directors really like him, because he's, and he'll challenge them. He'll challenge you. He'll challenge, you know, he'll say, well, I don't know.
But he goes the extra mile to know the footage, because then he's in a place of, I know that there's something else better or whatever.
Yeah, and I then I don't care who the editor is, whether it's Steve or whether it's, you know, this editor, Robert, who turned out great as to Charlie. Everybody's got their own MO, but you know for the first month, 2 months, it's horrible. The footage is horrible. You're never going to make another film. It's the dailies look great, and then the first cut is the worst thing you've ever seen in your life. So you just made this home movie. You know, you might as well throw some credits on it and send it to your dad.
You know, is that on every project?
Every single project I've ever seen, even on the episodics. You know, it's like, you know, so you get it, and it's it gets better and better, and then you've got ideas, and then you cut the shit out of it. You know, you cut it way down, or you change things around. And I mean, I did that, and we've done that in every single film. I remember Bat 21, I know we're at least 70 minutes long, which is ridiculous. You're cutting 70 minutes out. But I've done X-Files. Where I've always tried, whenever I've gone into episodes, I say, could you get this thing down to like 48 pages or 52, you know, because it's going to be 42 minutes.
Yeah.
And it's still going to be long. So the shorter, the better, and it'll be, we'll have more time shooting, and it'll be a much better film. And sometimes I'm shooting a 60-page script.
And you got to shoot it all.
You have to shoot it all. Yeah. And then it's like, and then then they want all the close-ups, and that ruins the movie, because that's the only way you can cut it down to the 42 minutes. Yeah. And I had a X-Files that came in at, okay, so it's 62 minutes. We cut it down to 42 minutes. Let me think about that.
Yes.
Say 50 minutes really worked great. It was amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
It still worked, but it's
you cut a third of it.
Yeah, yeah,
wow.
Yeah. When I do movies of the week, was it Flight 93 or I did a film on McCain, Faith of My Fathers. I did rewrites on both those, so I would get the script down to 90 pages.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was you got 92 minutes, or say 88 to 92 minutes, something like that for a TV movie. So it's kind of like double, so it's maybe 88. So then you know you're in the ballpark, and you're still long.
Yeah.
You're still cutting out 15 minutes or 20 minutes.
And at that point, it gets on TV for broadcast, you're getting down to the frames. Like, you can't go over. Like, it has to be, whatever, 42 and
it has to be 20. Has to be the frame.
Yeah, to the frame.
On TV, has to be the frame, yeah.
And there's no, like, oh, I need another second. There is no other second.
And we were really long on this film. This script was 82 pages.
Okay.
And we were at almost 2 hours.
Yeah.
Which was, I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
You know, so it actually kept getting better and better and better the more we cut. Sure. So the more you can do it on the script, you know.
Up front, then, yeah, more time to be creative, more time to focus on the shots that you know and the scenes you know are going to be in.
Yeah. I remember doing an ER, 80 scenes, 80 scenes.
80 scenes.
80 scenes, yeah. That was a record at the time. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, so 80 scenes. Okay, so I've got 8 days to shoot it. So, you know.
10 scenes a
and,
day.
And a lot of them were long. A lot of them, you know, the line steady camming through everybody, 2 minute takes,
Type
of thing.
So after you finish post, I think you're entering into another territory, marketing, the visibility of the film. Usually on a studio film, there's entire departments ready to take over and already setting up stuff and publicizing the film and sharing it. What were the challenges for your film to enter into that world, which is always changing, of how do I represent my film? How do I get in front of eyeballs? How do I get people interested? What was your approach and how's it going so far?
Well, we're kind of down to the wire because we really never got the social media going. Mm-hmm. Freestyle hired a group for a month, mm-hmm. which is not probably long enough. I mean, because a lot of people start this months in advance. So they're working on the social media. Freestyle is going to take some ads. They also own a bunch of HD stations, so they're mm-hmm. they're putting 30-second spots on those. They have a viewership of like 75 million. But I don't know if that really translates, you know, because I'm not even sure where those channels are.
It's not one for one, yeah. One of them could be the home network or whatever.
You have no idea. So it's you just hope people, go to, iTunes and, click on Odds Are. You know, you can find through Odds Are. You go on the pre-order page now where it is. And on August 7th, it'll be out somewhere. And
that's
hopefully
not easy to do, though, to get on iTunes before and have it for pre-sale, is it?
Well, yeah, no, it's on, they actually have, so they'll do new releases, mm-hmm. then they'll do thrillers, whatever.
Yeah.
They have whole categories and they have pre-order.
Okay.
Available in the future. So right. we're on the pre-order page, which is right. hard to get.
Oh, for sure.
So you click on that and you can pre-order, or you just click on the site and it shows you the movie, and then you're reminded to, you know, check on it later because right. you're probably not going to remember the right. date, and then order it that way.
Now on some of the papers that I saw, that on August 7th, it's coming out on like 20 different
yeah.
like platforms, from iTunes to across the board. Like
yeah, anywhere. DirecTV on demand.
Who does that, or how do you get on all these platforms?
Freestyles does that. Okay. Yeah, they take on a certain limited number of films a year. Okay. This is one of the films they did, and they have relationships with the distributors.
Okay.
You know, with the outlets, mm-hmm. and that's how they got it on. Because you look through iTunes, you see there's tons of films on there. Yeah. There's tons of films on Netflix.
Yeah.
But how many independent films do you think were made in a year?
Right.
It's like 40,000 or something like that. It's absolutely absurd.
Yeah.
It could be more, yeah. you know. So you're lucky to get on, mm-hmm. on the iTunes website. You're lucky to get it on all those different platforms.
Right.
And then also we're doing the same thing with foreign. We have a different foreign distributor called Devil Works.
And there's different platforms globally that are popular in those areas, right. I'm sure.
Right, and one of the things you also do in order to have awareness is we've made the behind-the-scenes thing, which yeah. we're trying to get viral, which is coming close, which I think any independent filmmaker is going to get a big kick out of. And then also the trailer. We cut a really good trailer ourselves, and yeah. that was on our website. But then Freestyle hired a company called Co-Creative, mm-hmm. and they have an editor there, I think his name is Morgan, who cut a hell of a good trailer. And he doesn't tell nearly as much of the story.
It's about feel and tone.
Yes, and his thing is minute and a half, no longer than a minute and a half.
Yeah.
And you know what? I agree with that, because it doesn't is tell, and it's like the attention span you're dealing with,
right.
limited attention span. So the minute and a half works. And I think he did a really nice job presenting the film.
Conveyed enough of the story to mm-hmm. get you hooked.
Yeah.
And say like, oh,
yeah, he just eliminated some of the action, which was yeah. something that I had a little bit of a problem with. But,
yeah.
you know, I basically said, oh, you throw all the action, and I said, no, it was. But it's very effective. So we took our trailer off and put his trailer on the on the website.
And do you have any desire, or is there even a need for a theatrical push to try and four-wall it or get it out? Or how does,
you know, we never really thoughts? Looked into that. I mean, if we had had a partner,
yeah.
you know, they could have taken it out, because I did meet with a high-end company that we're working with on another project.
Yeah.
And they said, we probably would have consider taking this thing out and put it in 12 theaters.
Yeah.
You would have spent like 80,000 bucks, you know, and have some sort of a release, and then you can go to these markets.
Right. But you know? I find more often than not, it's either same day, like day and date, or they just go digitally. They go to every platform. Everyone's consuming. I don't know about you. I consume a lot more stuff now on my laptop, my iPhone, my iPad. I have no problem watching something like this, and, you know, or watching at home on a beautiful system instead of just going to the theater, you know?
Yeah.
How do you feel?
The theaters are, they're inconsistent. I mean, I like the lounge chairs.
Yeah.
And but some of the theaters, the screens aren't as good as your iPad.
They're dim and they're yeah. washed out. And
yeah.
I hate when you have like the exit signs, they glow yeah, the, green
the exit
or
signs,
red on the screens.
They drive me crazy. But if you want to, you know, if you see a film on a decent, you know, size iPad.
Yeah.
It's not bad. And then this, you know, I've got an old LCD. I mean, and it's like, it looks fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I prefer watching.
Yeah, so, I mean, I watched The Revenant there, you know,
okay.
and on Blu-ray. It was fantastic.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, so it's hard for, plus, you know, I'm an old dad with young kids, so we don't go to the movies very often.
Right.
You know, and we get all the scum in the Academy, so we get all the screeners, and then we get all the TV screeners. So
you can share it here at home, yeah.
Yeah.
Is there something you learned during this shoot that you didn't know before, in terms of, like, you started independent, you were in the studio system, you've done the biggest shows on both TV and the movie theaters. Like, is there something you learned this time around that you didn't expect?
Well, it's the social media thing. It's because that was something we never had to worry about before, because it was basically getting the trailers out in the theater and buying ads.
Yep.
Because I remember when I was doing Youngblood, the administration changed for the third time. And I think it went from Ted Turner to Jerry Weintraub or something. And Jerry did this fantastic thing where he saw the film. He said, we can make some money with this. So he was going out with Rocky, and he took the original trailers off Rocky and put 90 trailers of Youngblood on the Rocky trailers, which helped us get going, you know, so.
Visibility again, yeah.
Visibility, yeah. So, but that's not the type of thing that, you know, people, the kids are all looking at Rotten Tomatoes, you know, the scores, and they're, you know, they're getting the reviews online, and, and they're watching them online, too.
They're watching online?
Yes,
and then I
so
find
it's huge difference.
And I find it's definitely word of mouth. If someone vouches for it, then I'm like, all right, I'll go see that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I mean, it's, and ours is like, because Odds Are is a good title, because you do Odds Are. If you do Odds Are a movie, it comes up right away.
Yeah.
I mean, so far that hasn't changed. Yeah. It usually comes up right away.
Okay.
Odds Are, not necessarily. The main thing we want to do is get people to get hits on iTunes. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the best platform to be on right now, I think. I mean, it's this all new to me. Maybe we'll do well on demand. And then there's an afterlife. After these, we go through these original platforms. This is the Netflixes and various
other places. Is that the second window?
Second window. And then there's all foreign, too. Yeah. You know, we've had some feedback that this film might do really well in Asia.
Okay.
So, and that's a big market. I'm not not necessarily growing. China, but it would be, you know, Taiwan and South Korea and Japan and so forth. So again, we're kind of in the hands of the distributors, Freestyle and Devil Works.
Okay.
And you know, right now I'm working with executive producer Graham Jones, and he and I are like doing Instagram, which is like, I'm like all thumbs. It's like, at any rate.
No, it's a process. Cause I mean, Vashi Visuals, like I'm on, you know, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, all that stuff. And it takes a lot to curate and handle everything and share things about either myself or filmmaking that I find interesting. It's a challenge and it's not easy, you know, and each platform needs a different kind of love, you know?
Yeah.
It's not the same. You can't just put the same image and the same message across all three. It has to be positioned to be, you know, for each of the platforms.
Well, it's a full-time job. Yeah, for the people that are really trying to get the followers, you have to be on it all day.
Yeah.
You know, because you have to post, you have to comment,
respond,
you have to follow,
interact.
Yes, interact.
Yeah.
But the number one thing, I mean, learning this from my daughter,
they're
only on Instagram. That's it.
Yeah.
They don't do Snapchat anymore. It's Twitter, forget about it.
Yeah. It's very fluid, isn't it?
Facebook, no. Yeah. It's all Instagram right now. So we're trying to work the Instagram thing, you know, downloading stuff and, you know, making mistakes and, you know, doing our little videos and so forth.
Good. Good. I'll put that all up there on the link when I'm done. Is there anything else you want to share? Or did I miss anything from your?
Well, the only
adventures?
Thing is, did we go through? I would say the one thing I would say is that it's. I would say this is, along with the first film I did, this is the second best experience I had. This was infinitely harder for multiple reasons. Also, put a lot of pressure on the family because we're shooting the house, and I thought that they were going to maybe get a hotel room or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
So we're shooting. The kid never woke up at all.
Okay,
you could have shot in his room, and it would. But it put a lot of pressure on my wife, you know, so, but she hung in there. She actually helped me get the film set up. So it's, you know, get a really good partner, you know, you don't have to have a big crew, get a really good AD. I had an AD, Peter Merwin, came in and just kicked ass because he was only in for like 2 weeks before, 3 weeks before. I think he gave me a free week and then 2 weeks.
That's huge.
And because I had been doing the boards, which was on this kind of new website, which was really cool. But at least it got me organized. So you could take that and then make it work, because my board never would have worked.
Right. Do you storyboard almost everything?
Didn't
shot,
storyboard
scene,
never or? Storyboarded.
No.
Never
okay.
storyboard. And even when I've done huge action scenes, you know, you really didn't storyboard. The only thing we storyboarded was the gag falling into the pool.
Yeah,
so we had Chris Peachin do the boards, really good boards. But then you kind of look at them, and then you're there, and you see something else, and you figure out how much time you have. But then we built a platform about halfway up, about 15 feet up, and then we had Andy, the diver, do a flip and land on his back.
Okay.
So he did that. And then you're paying the stunt guys. The stunt guys come in kind of at scale, which is no big deal.
Yeah.
But then for every gag, they get, between $700 and $1,500.
Yeah.
So how many times are you going to have them? And you got to let them do it twice.
Yeah.
Because they're showed, because
you
know, one and done. It's just the girl falling down the stairs.
Yeah.
That's why when I, with Corinne, that's why I put her in the long pants, but she looks great in them. I mean, they're form fitted in a tight shirt, but the shirt was long sleeves. So when
pat
that,
it up.
Yeah, pat it up. So, you know, that's from having done films. So we're going to do this very tight stairs, you know.
Yeah.
So we brought some padding on the stairs that Ben Scott had from a previous film. It looked fine. And then she was totally padded up from head to toe, from wrist to, you know. And then the first time it was okay, and then he's got laid into her, said, you can do better than that.
Yeah,
you're not going to lay, you're going to let go of that railing, and you're going to push off.
Yeah.
You know, so she did it twice. Second time was great.
Right. So if she was wearing cutoff shorts and a tank top,
you're screwed.
It's not going to look real.
It's $5,000.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the way it works. I mean, first of all, you got to get somebody to do it. Then you have to get a stunt person that's going
to match.
You're going to have to get the stunt coordinator to authorize it. And I'm not sure he's going to authorize something like that.
Right.
Because you have to bring him in before, and you say, and because I had Ben Scott come in and Tim McGillicuddy, they're both fantastic. Come in and talk to them about it. And they told me what to build. Build a platform at the end, you know, so it doesn't go down to the concrete.
Right.
So, and we're going to pad it up. And, you know, if you've gotten a wardrobe. And I said, I've already done the wardrobe, so we're fine. We've already established it. I knew that. He said, thank you very much. Otherwise, we might not. This looks like a really tough one.
Yeah.
The falls are hard downstairs.
Oh, God. Yeah.
I mean, especially wood steps.
Yeah. Did you also have someone, did someone jump behind the diver off the roof? Or was the camera... You throw a camera?
No, we did a CGI shot. I mean, we did a green screen that we shot right out here against the garage.
Okay.
Or the guest house, really.
So you did have some green screens.
We did one, yeah. Yeah,
okay.
Where all he does is just basically behind him, and he's kind of waving his arms. And we did that in 20 different angles and so forth.
And you just comp that in
to fake the and the first time I showed my kid that, he said, oh, that's so bogus. That is so bogus, because he's looking at all these $200 million films.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I kept looking at it, and we took another take, and then we cut it from 2 seconds down to maybe 18 frames.
Just enough to read.
That's what it is. You realize because you think it's, I mean, I thought it looked great longer, you know, a second and a half, but no, he was right.
Yeah. You took it out, then you just comprehend enough of the, that it's, oh shit, this movie always falls.
Yeah. But then we had lots of angles when we had three cameras when Andy did his stunts.
Sure.
So we had different angles of that, and we had underwater and all that. So we were able to make that
that's
work.
Covered, yeah. That's great.